And now to the COVID vaccine, as children under 5 are still not eligible for protection. Moderna announced plans last month to seek emergency use authorization of their COVID vaccine for babies and toddlers after seeing promising results in a clinical study. Do you have a young one in this age group? What do you want to ask the infectious disease physician about COVID vaccines? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Nasia Safdar is Associate Dean for Clinical Trials at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and Research Director of the new Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. That's a partnership between UW-Madison and UW Health. Dr. Safdar, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So what is the status of a COVID vaccine and the development for children under 5?
You know, I think what we know at this point is that there's several additional trials underway, and I think that the results of that will determine what eventually happens with a vaccine. I don't doubt that it will eventually happen, but I understand that everyone must be very frustrated that it hasn't already occurred.
I think you've heard so many parents probably say, what is taking so long in the clinical trial process? Can you take us inside that process and what that might be like?
So in general, you know, there is no substitute for a clinical trial for determining the effectiveness of a vaccine, especially for something that we really don't know much about and can't really go by already known knowledge about it. So when these trials are done, the focus is really on two things. You know, one is safety and the other is effectiveness. And they're both important. And of course, safety is the primary concern with anything that's new and uncertain, especially in children and especially in smaller children, who are a very vulnerable group because they're still developing, and you really can't extrapolate adult data to that in children.
Oh, so you would, I would imagine then it's really difficult to find the right dosage for babies and for toddlers.
That's exactly right. So ultimately, you know, at some level, one has to make one's best guess estimate based on what you believe to be the right dose. But as we saw, and it is quite possible that that may have to be revised.
What will the Food and Drug Administration take into consideration before it does approve a vaccine for children under 5?
So I think still those two things, and a very careful scrutiny of those. So the primary one is safety, and that, as best as we can tell from what has been published or written about in these trials, is that safety appears to be very good, which is highly reassuring, of course. And then the other is effectiveness. Then you wonder, you know, effectiveness of what? Effectiveness against the infection or effectiveness of preventing hospitalization? And fortunately, you know, with COVID cases having dropped in the U.S. and elsewhere, some of the outcomes have not occurred, which is good in some respects, but then also that doesn't help in determining the effectiveness of the vaccine against the severe outcomes.
Right. And I think if I'm hearing this right, is that you have to really weigh the side effects of the vaccine versus the effectiveness of, say, keeping that child, you know, safer from the Omicron variant or another variant of COVID, not having the side effects outweigh the safety and effectiveness against that variant.
That's right. And so, you know, if a vaccine is effective, if it's highly effective, then one can make the argument that, well, you know, we're in the midst of a surge, we need to do this vaccine, and then we'll follow carefully and monitor for the side effects, as happened earlier in the pandemic. And now I think the bar is somewhat higher. We really want to make sure that what you're delivering to little children is effective without exposing them to any untoward effects.
So the CDC found that there were record numbers of children under 5 who had been hospitalized during the Omicron surge, but CDC has since said that nearly all people can safely stop wearing masks in public indoor spaces, even young children in schools. So how should parents with young unvaccinated children negotiate that, navigate safety and risk in this time without a vaccine?
You know, I think ultimately it comes down to your own perception about how risk averse you would like to be. And the parents of small children are often very risk averse, understandably. So I think even though it's not a requirement anymore that people wear masks in public places, the parents of small children may still advise them to do so. And of course, the very small kids might not be able to do it. But over the age of 2, most children are able to. Of course, it's a hard thing for them to do because they have uncomplainingly done this throughout the pandemic.
Yes.
But I think until we have a vaccine, especially those little kids with chronic conditions that puts them at risk, I would still encourage the use of masks.
I really appreciate your word uncomplainingly, because I can see that in my children who just see it now as routine. Get the mask out the door. Get another mask in the backpack, you know, as a backup. They do it automatically.
They are definitely the heroes of this pandemic.
Let's look at the age groups, the approved age groups here. And, you know, first it was kids age 12 through 18, then 5 to 11. Next up are the under fives. But how do these age divisions happen? And you know, how do these groupings happen?
So it has to do, you know, some of it is a little arbitrary, but the other rationale for doing it is that you're looking at development of the immune system, you're looking at body mass distribution of the vaccine, and so those things are important when it comes to determining the dosage and in determining how many series you might need or how many doses in a series you might need. And so many other vaccine trials over the years have used the same age strata, and so I think that's pretty well embedded at this point.
With these age groups for the children, the 12 to 18, 5 to 11, what are you seeing in terms of uptake of COVID vaccine, and how is that going?
You know, I think in the earlier days when it was first authorized, I think there was a lot of excitement and the uptake was brisk. And since then, I think it has somewhat leveled off. And of course, there's a lot of variation around the country in when and how people have chosen to get it. Nonetheless, I think, you know, uptake has been steady. Would be great if it was even more accelerated. But in the older children, especially, I think parents were really waiting to have this. And once it was available, they did make use of it.
We have infectious disease physician Nasia Safdar stays with us on COVID vaccines, children, the latest on COVID clinical trials, as she heads up research for the Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. What do you wonder about clinical trials and the various stages and the process to them? Would you participate in one? Has someone in your life participated in a clinical trial? What was that like? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Dr. Safdar here on the Ideas Network. We're getting up to speed on COVID vaccines, clinical trials, the process involved to get a COVID vaccine for the youngest children under five. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Institutes of Health, the NIH, announced last week that it's kicking off a clinical trial evaluating a second COVID booster for adults. And the study includes multiple variant vaccines. The NIH says adults interested in joining the study should visit clinicaltrials.gov and search for the COVAIL trial. It's not recruiting yet, as I last checked. What do you wonder about clinical trials? Have you been in one? What was that like? Still time, 800-642-1234. Dr. Nasia Safdar is Associate Dean for Clinical Trials at UW School of Medicine Public Health, Research Director at the Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. Dr. Safdar, I was on the NIH's clinical trials portal site yesterday. I was amazed. I was blown away by the sheer number of COVID-related clinical trials that are happening around the world or ones that are about to begin. Can you comment on this perhaps exploding research area?
I think it's been very heartening to see that people have come together in these large collaborative groups in a very short period of time. And I think it's a recognition early on of the fact that despite everything else that people were doing to stop transmission, like distancing, like masking, and not leaving their homes and so on, you know, those measures are not really sustainable. And the thing that was going to bring this pandemic to a slow crawl or ideally to a halt was going to be the vaccines. So I think the investment and the commitment, and of course the participants without whom there can be no trials, all reflect that.
Oh, and the collaboration between institutions and the federal government. I mean, there has got to be an immense amount of collaboration here between scientists.
That is probably the silver lining of this pandemic, is the information sharing and the fact that people really took the time to learn from each other to avoid repeating some of the the trials that we had done and to really focus on high impact, high yield things that could really change the way this pandemic unfolded.
So back in September, you started your role as Associate Dean for Clinical Trials and the Research Director of the Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. Can you tell us what is the focus for UW Clinical Trials and what is it looking at specifically in the area of COVID?
So the focus for the clinical trials is really to diversify and to broaden and deepen the portfolio of clinical trials that happen at SMPH and UW Health, whether these are partnerships with industry, investigator-initiated, federally sponsored, you know, they run the whole spectrum of those trials. And of course, being a large medical care center for much of the state and beyond, and a large academic institution, it's a unique opportunity to partner the talent that exists here with the enthusiasm of the participants that really have been seeking opportunities to join clinical trials. We want to make sure that anybody that has an interest in it in a clinical trial is able to. So removing barriers to access is going to be a really important aspect of it. And ultimately, I think, you know, whatever the patient needs are, what the conditions are that need intervention and innovation, that's where the clinical trials will be.
And when you say diversify and deepen clinical trials, is that meaning that you really want to do more clinical trials and in getting into more areas than what you are currently?
That, and then also expanding within the areas that we already are. You know, the major health, chronic health conditions that affect the population and the number and the type of trials should reflect that. So that includes cancer, cardiac conditions, strokes, you know, in this case with the pandemic, COVID. And then the participants in the trials should really be reflective of the population that will eventually be using this product once it's approved. So making sure that adequate representation is there. And in the past, you know, clinical trials have not really paid heed to that and has not been a focus. But now it's really not possible to run a clinical trial without good representation of all the populations that will eventually benefit from the product that results from it.
How difficult is it to get the number and diversity of participants that you need to run a clinical trial?
Well, I think that's really the linchpin of every clinical trial. You know, you can't have any results, you really can't make any progress unless you have the participants. So we're very grateful to the Wisconsin population that has come out in droves to participate in these really important trials. There is no substitute to determining the effectiveness and the efficacy of a new product other than clinical trial participation. But for any clinical trial, that is the single most important thing that they must focus on is the recruitment and retention of participants.
Late last year, UW Health was involved in testing a Moderna vaccine for children 6 months to 12 years. What did you learn through that trial and other COVID-related vaccine trials?
You know, for most COVID-related vaccine trials, I think the big thing that we have found is that there's been a lot of interest in participation, mm-hmm. which has been great. It has allowed results to come out far quicker than they would have otherwise. I think a lot of research infrastructure evolved during the pandemic in response to some of the restrictions. You know, for instance, consenting participants became remote in many instances where the trial was able to be done that way, really made it easier for people to join. Some of the trials that the NIH is running, there is no need for an in-person visit. The drug is dispensed by mail. The consenting is done remotely. So those things, I think, have made it easier for people who otherwise would find it hard to participate.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar about clinical trials. She's an associate dean for clinical trials at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, research director of the new Wisconsin Medicine Institute for Clinical Trials. Join in at 800-642-1234. So what is it like to work with the big pharmaceutical companies on these clinical trials, Moderna and Pfizer? And what is that working relationship like, especially with these COVID vaccine trials?
Well, I think, you know, they've taken the lead in making sure that the vaccines are developed, that trials are done in a timely manner, and that the results are peer reviewed and publicly displayed and so on. So I think that within that infrastructure of transparency, of safety, of paying really close attention to diversity and engagement of participants, you know, without that partnership, we would still, I think, be in the early days of the pandemic where, if we remember, things were pretty, pretty terrible.
I remember talking with you in those early days, and there were so many unknowns. Do you feel like there is a clearer picture now for what we're dealing with COVID-19?
Well, I think a lot clearer, but certainly not everything is known. And, you know, viruses have a way of surprising us. So, for instance, even though we can predict and model what the fall will look like, it could entirely be that we would be surprised yet again. I think the good thing is that no matter what happens going forward, at least we have a robust array of tools. You know, of course, there's a vaccine, but in addition, there are also therapeutics that can be used in people who are either hospitalized or are not sick enough to be hospitalized, but sick enough to need treatment. So those things are all new. And since they've come about, it has led me to be a lot more reassured.
Do you imagine that there will be a need for a second booster in the fall?
You know, it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. I think we'll have to see what sort of iteration of the virus and what variant emerges, but it would not surprise me if that was the case.
In the area of therapeutics and someone who is hospitalized with COVID, you've seen advancements there. Can you explain what is most promising when your loved one is faced with this hospitalization and fighting COVID?
You know, sometimes I think that's another thing we learned from this pandemic is that you really have to retest and repurpose medications that exist for other indications to see whether they might be helpful for this. And steroids, of course, changed mortality in COVID when given to patients who were hospitalized. So very old medication used for a whole host of indications and also worked for COVID. In addition, there are a lot of other novel medications that were tested in trials found to be effective, although the spectrum of effectiveness has varied from group to group. But there's a whole array of them now that are used for hospitalized patients. And then there are two that are available for people who are not hospitalized, who have had a short duration of illness, but have risks that will make it, you know, difficult for them to cope with severe COVID should they get it, such as those who are immunocompromised. And so, you know, using those medications is going to be really important.
Dr. Safdar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Nasia Safdar, Associate Dean for Clinical Trials at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.